you could run the risk through repeated exposure to the Terry O'Brien Show of being detoxed. I thought about that a lot when I saw this item. I don't know if you guys saw this item. I've got to get to my other screen here. Nearly one in five Americans had mental illness in 2009. This was reported on Thursday, according to U.S. government researchers. This is kind of interesting. Young adults aged 18 to 25 had the highest level of mental illness at 30%, while those 50 and older had the lowest, said a report by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA. I'll try saying that three times. The rate, slightly higher than last year's 19.5% figure, reflected increasing depression, especially among the unemployed. What I thought was interesting was that the highest rate of level of mental illness was among the youngsters. Isn't that Obama's demographic? 347-838-8799, the number in the program. Okay, so now the moment has arrived, something really exciting that I was hoping would happen, and it's actually happened. I've got to be honest with you guys, I am almost never nervous when I'm on the air or speaking in public ever. Last time I felt a little bit nervous like this was when I interviewed the late, great Caspar Weinberger on the program. And so now, though, I have the pleasure, the unique pleasure and the honor of bringing on a patriot, a former congressman who chaired the Armed Services Committee in the House for most of the time of the Iraq War, a former Army Ranger, an amazing individual by the name of Congressman Duncan Hunter. Is this really you, Congressman Hunter?
Hey, Terry, it's me, and those accolades are all really nice, but I just called my granddaughters, and I asked them if they really wanted me to come home. I'm in Washington, D.C., and they weren't too enthusiastic about it. So I'm glad somebody cares. But I just called up, called home in San Diego, and Lynn is taking care of the grandkids this weekend. So
they were like unimpressed. They said like, "Are you? What are you bringing?"
Not at
them,
all.
Right?
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
Well,
they want to know if I brought them something when I come home.
That's it. That's the thing. Yeah, well, but Congressman Hunter, guys, if you don't know, has written a great book that I'm in the process of reading now called Victory in Iraq, How America Won. And I suspect, Congressman Hunter, I want you to elaborate on this, but I suspect the reason that you wrote the book was basically to set the record straight, to kind of set the record straight about what has really happened, because the media has just been determined to distort what has really happened in our U.S. involvement in Iraq. So, I mean, is that really what motivated you to write the book?
Well, I think, Terry, you've got a good piece of this right in that Americans don't understand that we haven't just left Iraq. We've clearly won the war there, and we're leaving with our objectives accomplished. And, you know, we had the big fight in the western part of Iraq. That was with the Sunni tribes in Anbar province, the big battles in Fallujah, Ramadi. And Al-Qaeda came in after we had been in Iraq for about 8 months, 2004. We joined with the Sunni tribes, got them to turn against Al-Qaeda with the Americans fighting side by side with us, and we wiped out Al-Qaeda in western Iraq. And then with the surge that we put in place in 2007, we undertook a counterinsurgency campaign against the Shiite extremists in eastern Iraq. And we won that part of the war also, and finally we stood up a government, an elected government, and a military that was capable of protecting it. So Iraq is not Iowa, but it was never supposed to be, and it was never supposed to be like the United States. But we went in to have a country that would have a modicum of democracy, which it has, would be a friend, not an enemy of the U.S. as it was under Saddam Hussein, and which would not be a launching pad for terrorism. And we have achieved that. And my youngest son, Sam, both my sons served there, but my son, Duncan, served there as a Marine with the 1st Marine Division in the early years of the war. My son, Sam, came out with the last combat unit that the Army had, which was a 4th Striker Brigade. And the 4th Striker Brigade was in Iraq for a year, did not take a single American killed in action. That's how quiet we've left Iraq. And so when I saw President Obama say, "I'm ending the war," I thought it was important to set the record straight, because he didn't end the war. The Americans who fought those tough battles and stitched together that government ended the war by winning. And, you know, we Americans are reluctant to acknowledge to our military people when they won. The newspapers, and especially the Washington Post and the New York Times, love to bring up any time we stumble in the world. But they're very reluctant to acknowledge that we've won. But we've clearly won in Iraq, and I think that's important for the million-plus people that served there.
Oh, it's really important, and it's a great historical document. I'm really enjoying this one chapter I want to ask you a question about. But about Barack Obama, when he was talking about, you know, the war is lost, and he's running around with his buddy Harry Reid, and when he was saying all that stuff about Iraq, what color panties do you suppose he was wearing?
Well, I do know this about Barack Obama. Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton tried to stop the surge.
Yes, that's the chapter I want to talk to you about, Chapter 17, The Political Fight. And the thing I love about this chapter is I have always said here on the Terry O'Brien Show, I never want anyone to forget that the Democrats in the Congress in the 1970s and the early 1970s have a lot of blood on their hands. And when we talk about the killing fields and we talk about what happened in Southeast Asia, let's not forget what they did. And you bring it up again, that they were trying to do the same darn thing again.
There's a very close parallel between Iraq and Vietnam, except we had a different ending in Iraq. And what happened in Vietnam was in 1972, Creighton Abrams was the chief of staff of the Army or was the combatant commander in Vietnam, and he had turned war around. And in 1972, we had no Americans fighting on the ground. We did give air cover and provide air support, but we had no Americans fighting on the ground. And the North Vietnamese attacked South Vietnam with all 17 of their divisions. They hit them at Quang Tri in the north, at Con Tum in the Central Highlands, and at An Lac near Saigon in South Vietnam. General Giap, who was the North Vietnamese communist leader, put every division he had into South Vietnam and hurled themselves at the South Vietnamese defenders. The South Vietnamese held, knocked them back, destroyed about half of their tanks, and defeated them very badly. And at that point, Creighton Abrams, who was the head of the U.S. military operation there, came home feeling that we had won the war. Watergate then happened, and Nixon resigned. We lost the commander-in-chief. The Democrats had huge gains in 74 in the Watergate year at the polls, and the Kennedy Amendment cut back South Vietnam's military aid from the U.S. to 25% of what it had been. And the South Vietnamese at that point rationed their soldiers to two bullets per soldier per day. Two bullets per soldier per day. So if people ask, how did we lose the war in Vietnam, and you have these long discussions about whether we held our mouth right or we didn't quite do this right or do that right, we got cut our friends back to where they had two bullets per soldier per day. And the Chinese and the Russians pushed 800,000 tons of military equipment onto their side, and they rode that mountain of weapons right down Highway 1, and it was really more of an execution than it was a victory in 1975. Now, that almost happened in Iraq, because the Iraq Study Group in 2007, in January 2007, said we should get out. And instead of getting out, President Bush said, I'm going to send another 20,000 Americans, another five brigades. As soon as he announced that, known as the surge, Senator Biden, who was the modern-day version of William Fulbright, the liberal senator of the Foreign Affairs Committee, who had helped to cut South Vietnam's jugular in 1974, Joe Biden tried to stop the surge. He issued the anti-surge resolution, resolution number 2, in January of 2007. Hillary Clinton joined him. Barack Obama joined him, opposing the surge. And, of course, Ted Kennedy, who got to play in both scenes. He both cut the jugular of South Vietnam in 1974, and he tried to do it again with respect to Iraq, but they lost. They failed to stop the surge. The surge worked. We pulled violence down in the first 7 months by about 80%. We totally won Anbar province, and in the end, the last impediment to statehood for Iraq, to really having a strong country there, was was taking care of Muqtada al-Sadr, who was the anti-American Shiite cleric, and the 1st Iraqi Division defeated him in Basra in 2008.
Yeah, he
and
was
so
the guy
in 2000,
that... Oh, I'm sorry. He was the guy that used to have, like, an ottoman on his head. Yeah, I remember that guy. He was, yeah, he was a strange... Hey, I have a couple more questions for you, but I want to...
Oh, go right ahead. Listen, I don't mean to monologue either, so go right ahead.
I want to play a soundbite for you. You first came to my attention in a big way in 2005 when a number of the same usual suspects you're talking about now, the liberal Democrats, were whining about the treatment of enemy combatants at Gitmo. And I'm going to play a soundbite for you. This is when they were talking, many of these folks were talking about torture. And you were on C-SPAN, and you said this.
What is it, the lemon fish? Are the oven fried chicken? Which torture are you going to take from Guantanamo?
And I remember you also talked about the orange peel chicken and the rice pilaf too.
That's exactly right. What I did is I simply got the menus that we were serving people at Guantanamo and published them. And for a while, that totally zonked the liberals who were painting these pictures of these guys hanging from chains from the ceilings at Guantanamo. And no, they had honey on Friday. The Friday that we went down there, they had honey glazed chicken, rice pilaf. And I think the next day they had lemon fish. And, you know, we looked at the health records of these guys. Incidentally, when I went to Guantanamo and took a codel of congressional delegation of Democrats and Republicans down there, Mrs. Bordaio, who was the congresswoman from Guam, came out. The C-SPAN or the CNN camera was right there to get her first remarks as she left Guantanamo. And she said these words. She said, "This is a country club." And, of course, they didn't run that soundbite. But when we went down there, they'd all gained over 5 pounds that year. They were playing soccer as we left. They had a five times a day, they had the broadcast from our speakers that were around the institution. They had prayer broadcast to them. And they all had taxpayer-paid-for Qurans and prayer beads. And none of the guards touched the Qurans that they had. They would check them for security reasons. They put on their white gloves before they touched them. And so Guantanamo. And of course, I think this president now kind of realizes that. What do you do with these guys that have killed Americans on the battlefield? Guys like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is a self-proclaimed mastermind of 9/11. The idea that we're going to move them back and put them in a prison next to us, and we're going to put them in a prison with a lot of American criminals who then will learn how to make car bombs, that's not a very good idea. And so that was one of the true instances of the Democrat leadership shooting themselves in the foot with these promises to close Guantanamo.
Well, I don't know if you know about the horrors that have been going on at Gitmo lately, but back in September, there was reported that the detainees' diets at Gitmo had been greatly restricted, and now this is a horrific thing. I hope you're sitting down, because we thought when the jackbooted Bush administration left, these bad things wouldn't happen anymore, but apparently they're being limited now to only one serving of ice cream at every meal.
Yeah,
that's
life
been
is
reported.
Tough.
I'm telling you, you know. So
that's because they've all gained weight.
They're probably, Michelle probably went down there and said they're getting too obese. Now, I have a question for you about this fence, this 800-mile fence. Back in 2007, you remind me of what happened. Didn't you guys pass a law, and President Bush signed a law, that there was supposed to be a border fence built, and it was supposed to, didn't Chertoff say it was going to be built, like, within a year or something, and then nothing happened?
Well, first, we built the fence in San Diego, and I wrote the law that did that back in the early 90s, and we built a single fence and then a double fence when San Diego was the most prolific drug smuggling corridor in America, that 15 miles or so between the Pacific Ocean and the coastal hills between Tijuana and San Diego. Well, we built the double border fence there in San Diego, and I did that, wrote that into the law, and we made the Clinton administration do that. They did it under protest, but we actually reduced the crime rate in the county of San Diego by 54% after the double fence was built. So in 2006, I wrote the law that mandated the same type of fence be built across major smuggling corridors in New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. That really came out to about 850 miles of fence. And Mr. Chertoff tried his best to give the fence a slow roll. They tried to build a so-called virtual fence, which is no fence at all, which has been way over cost, and which I told them would be worthless. It's a bunch of guys trying to vector their cars around in the dead of night on the Arizona border with their laptops bouncing off the roof as they fall into gullies. So that didn't work. But they've done a little of the fencing. They've got 750 miles of some stuff, meaning they've got some vehicle barriers where the drug trucks were roaring through in certain places in Arizona and New Mexico. And they've got some double fence at some of the locations like Yuma. So we've done they've executed some of the fence, but not nearly enough, and we need to build the border fence. And it works. The border fence in San Diego has worked really, really well. And Jenna Napolitano had two complaints, and she would give them in the same breath. She would say, number one, the fence in San Diego doesn't work, and you show me a 12-foot fence, I'll show you a 12-and-a-half-foot ladder. And then she said, secondly, those mean old San Diegans have fenced their smuggling area, and now everybody comes across to Arizona. And so she complains, number one, that it doesn't work, and number two, that it works too well. I don't think she's decided which one she likes.
Oh, it's liberalism on parade. You know, on the back of the book, Victory in Iraq, How America Won, by our guest Duncan L. Hunter, which you guys all need to get, go to TerryO'Brien.com and click on the first link there, and you'll go right where it says Today on the Terry O'Brien Show, and you can go right to Amazon and get the book. There are three photographs on the back of three, like, really handsome guys. I mean, these are real hotties back here. You're one of them. You're in the center, Congressman. And then your two sons. And your one son, Duncan D. Hunter, is currently a California representative, yes?
He's a representative, he's on the Armed Services Committee, and he came back. You know, he came back from Iraq as a Marine, and he'd gotten out, and he helped me when I ran for president. And he was doing great speeches. He, after about 10 speeches, he said, "Dad, I'm a lot better than you are. I'm running for office."
Oh, that's so funny. Well,
he did. And, you know, incidentally, Terry, I think I can get an appointment with him sometime in February.
Oh, my God. Well, he's
back in
the news.
Washington, right? All we do is take care of the kids.
He's in the news today. I mean, he was responding to your senator. One of your senators has made some comments. I guess she's taken a page out of my senator, Dick Durbin's book. She likes to refer to our country as behaving like these dictators in other countries. But she apparently compared our country to North Korea and Pakistan because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I guess your son accurately said, I can probably think of few people less qualified to comment on our military than Mrs. Boxer. I think that's probably about the most accurate statement I've ever heard.
I think that's I think he made the right statement. You know, he's a good guy, and he's one of the very few combat veterans in Congress. There's not too many of them, and you know, he volunteered the day after 9/11. He walked in, quit his job, joined the Marines. He did two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And you know, the thing about Don't Ask, Don't Tell is it's all indulgence by the left. Very few of them are out there in close, tight quarters where you have no ability, no discretion in choosing who's in that those tight quarters with you. And most young people that go out to serve this country and defend our freedom are young conservative kids with Judeo-Christian values, and they have a tight unit cohesion because they share those values. And the idea, and I think it's especially wrong when in this country, in every one of the states where homosexual marriage was put on the ballot, it was defeated. I believe that's 31 states at this point. And yet these young people who serve our country, who are so valiant, in fact, one of the people in one of those pictures, Robert Kelly, who was a great young man, young Marine, was killed in Afghanistan as a platoon leader about 8 days ago. That's one reason I'm back here in D.C. But
oh,
the
I'm
idea
so
that these young people defend our country, and the liberal political establishment in this country wants to inject homosexuals into their ranks because that's what they want to do. And they have no concern about the rights to privacy of these young people who are out there in dangerous, difficult circumstances and don't want that. And if you ask any Marine platoon in Afghanistan or Iraq if they want to have this homosexuals injected into the ranks, the answer is no.
Oh, absolutely not. And, you know, it's a microcosm for liberalism overall because they always want to make rules for other people that they don't want to live by. I mean, that's kind of what they do. Now, what can we do? I mean, one thing I definitely have to first of all, tell you is give you my profound appreciation for coming on the program today. I'm a huge fan of yours. I've been a fan of yours for years. I'm enjoying your book, Victory in Iraq, How America Won. So thanks so much for writing that. And thank you for your family's awesome patriotism and service to our country. And what I want to ask you is, what can members of our audience here in the Terry O'Brien Show audience, what's the best thing we can do to support our men and women in the military?
You know, you need to watch the budgeting as we go into next year. First, try to keep Don't Ask, Don't Tell from passing in the last gasps of this lame duck Congress with the lobby for the gay lobby is out there lobbying very hard to get these folks that have been defeated at the polls to help the president pass this thing and make a political payment. And so so call your representatives and your senators and tell them not to pass this thing in a lame duck session. And, you know, people count the number of calls they get and they count the number of emails. Congressmen will walk in, and they may not say they may not say did this person call or did that person call, but they'll say what are the numbers, and their staff will tell them, Congressman or Senator, we got this number of calls against this provision, so work on keeping them from passing this thing with this lame duck session. Secondly, as we go into the budget fight this next year, keep them from cutting national defense, because the first thing they'll say is, okay, we'll cut the budget. We'll do the same thing that Clinton's did. We'll cut out military forces. That's not the right thing to do in this dangerous world.
Oh, you are so right. Well, we will definitely do that, and, of course, we will continue to donate to all the great organizations like Wounded Warriors Fund and all the other organizations that we talk about here on the Terry O'Brien Show. Congressman Hunter, this has been awesome. I hope you and your family have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And now that we've talked a little while, I'm a little less nervous, so that's all good. So I hope that you'll come back.
Well, come back. Terry, thank you so much. It's great to talk to you, and and thanks for the great conversation. And everybody out there who's been part of this very very marvelous turnaround that occurred on November 2nd, thanks for what you did. Let's make something of it.
Oh, that is so awesome. You know what? You get the bell for that. You get the bell. Congressman Hunter, have a great trip home, and have a great Thanksgiving, and God bless you.
Oh, God bless you, Terry. Thank you. Bye.
Congressman Duncan Hunter here on the Terry O'Brien Show, author of the new book, Victory in Iraq, How America Won. Go to terryobrien.com, and there's a link right there. First link says, Today on the Terry O'Brien Show. If you go there, you'll see a picture of the cover of the book. Click on it and go get it from Amazon. It's really a great historical document. And so I think it's something that is an essential in your library. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more about the subject with which we opened the program, the thing that has got me a little bit frosted, this Gilani case, and liberalism on parade all across America. More about that here on the Terry O'Brien Show.